Into the Weird, Episode 10, Evil Priestess Obsession.
To the Weird, a podcast about all things Marvel Bronze Age. I'm your host, Billy D, and with me is Herman Lowe, curator of the Long Box of Darkness. How are you, Herman?
I'm fine, thanks, Billy. I can't complain. I've been looking forward to recording again. It's been too long. Lots of things happened. I got bronchitis. You got your car totaled. Well, not totaled.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I'm exaggerating, listeners.
Well, might as well be.
Well, tell us about that, Billy. Is everything working out with the car? Because that's kind of a bit of bad luck there.
Yeah, it was a 3-for-1 deal. One car knocked into two others, so, you know, one accident and three cars damaged. So,
right in the driveway.
Yeah, right in my own driveway. So, yeah, good times.
Damn. Talk about the lords of bad luck here stepping in and, targeting Billy D. You've got a big old target on your back, man.
Yeah, I think Mephisto may have been behind this or somebody else that's nefarious.
That dude, man, he really bugs me, pisses me off. He better stay out of our business from here on out. I might seek the Silver Surfer on him.
Well, you know what? If he would come to me right now and whisper a deal to me, I might be taking it, Herman.
You'd be tempted. You'd be tempted.
Yeah. Go back in time. Okay. No problem.
Or you'd be bonded to, you know, a ghostly demon and fused to the dashboard of your car, permanently driving around looking to exact vengeance.
Yeah, it'd be like Christine all over again.
Oh, damn. Oh, man, that makes reinvigorates my Carpenter love. Yeah, we should watch The Fog again.
Oh, my gosh, so good.
Listeners, excuse us, we're going off on tangents here, but that's stuff we've been talking about lately, right, Billy? We want to get back into watching some horror movies again. Anyway, listeners, Into the Weird, Episode 10, we're going to be talking Dr. Stephen Strange again, as we are wont to do every other episode of Into the Weird features the Master of the Mystic Arts. And today, right, Billy, we're looking at two issues. So this is a twofer. Listeners, you get more bang for your buck. Two in one. We're looking at Marvel Premiere number 5 and 6. Mm-hmm. So, Billy, again, we're stuck in this Cthulhu-like mythos that Marvel has created under the auspices of Gardner Fox and, of course, Roy Thomas, who gave his okay and said, okay, just do this. We've acquired the Robert E. Howard properties. We might as well do some Lovecraft, even though they probably didn't formally approach Lovecraft's estate as they did with Robert E. Howard's estate. But, you know, in the beginning of each of these issues, they do say featuring concepts created by Robert E. Howard. And as we know, Robert E. Howard also played in the Cthulhu mythos as he was corresponding with H.P. Lovecraft in the early to mid-30s. So we'll start the ball rolling right away, right, Billy, now that the small talk's out of the way?
All the car accidents and everything else are out of the way, so we're good to go.
Yeah, we don't want to dwell too much on Mephisto and his machinations, how that might affect us. So here we go. Listeners, I'll give a short synopsis of first Marvel Premiere number 5, and then we'll discuss that, and then we'll do the same with Marvel Premiere number 6. Just to give the listeners a bit of background knowledge on what we've discussed so far, Billy, the last time, which was two episodes ago, or actually three episodes ago, before episode 8, I think it was episode 7, we discussed Marvel Premiere number 4, where Steven was trapped in this town of Starksboro, which is a very Lovecraftian setting. We've got these subhuman inhabitants who, at the time, we thought were interbreeding with these monstrous Cthulhu entities. But it turns out not to be the case, as we'll see in these issues. However, Steven was in dire straits because his magic didn't work. There was some kind of blanketing effect which leached all of his magic surrounding Starksboro, and it was the power, in fact, of this creature called Sligith. Or so we thought. It might later have been another creature too. You'll see what I mean, listeners, when we get to that. But suffice it to say that this town is infested with Lovecraftian cosmic entities from beyond the stars. So Steven is really having a hard time of it. Without his magic, he has to resort to his intelligence and his not too shabby fighting skills. And we left him the last time we talked, where he was chained to an altar in this church of Sligith. So I'm going to start with a synopsis, picking up where we left off during our last Stephen Strange episode. Okay, here we go. Marvel Premiere number 5. Writer Gardner Fox, artist Irv Westley, cover by Mike Plug, and it was cover dated November of 1972. Starring Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. And here we go with the synopsis. After being chained to the altar of Sligith in the cursed town of Starksboro, Steven manages to escape his chains with the help of the Cloak of Levitation and a mysterious force that counteracts Starksboro's magic-sapping effect. He barely manages to avoid being rent limb from limb by the reptilian Sligith, who is being egged on by a new character, Ebora, a priestess of Sligith and another mysterious foe who lurks in the depths of the ocean adjacent Starksboro. With his waning magic, Steven manages to beat back Sligith, sending the creature fleeing to its monstrous lair beneath the Starksboro church. Injured and exhausted, the Master of the Mystic Arts nevertheless follows the monster, intent upon its destruction. It is at this moment that we cut to a scene thousands of miles away where the Ancient One broods. It turns out that he was lending his power to Steven from afar to aid him in combating Sligith. But this has weakened the Ancient One and has left him vulnerable to the dreaded Shadow Men of the Sunken Ka'u, who promptly kidnap him. Then we are treated to a scene featuring the beautiful Clea, who makes a return, as she is awakened by a dream sent by Umar, the sister of the dreaded Dormammu, warning Clea that Steven is in danger and needs her help. Clea travels with Wong to Starksboro to lend her aid. Meanwhile, Steven confronts Sligith and bests him, albeit temporarily, only to be trapped in a flooding crevice, ready to be impaled by the vengeful Ebora. And that concludes the synopsis for Marvel Premiere number 5. So, Billy, what did you think of, firstly, the cover?
I love Mike Plug. I don't think I've ever seen a bad Mike Plug cover. This one is very good. It's a big, I shouldn't say a big improvement, but a very solid improvement over the issue we talked about beforehand. It's got some, you know, scary scene, a couple of dialogue boxes, but the colors are great. This giant clawed fist smashing from underneath the floor out like it's going to come kill Doctor Strange. Very, very good scene. It almost reminds me of something you'd see out of an old Vincent Price flick or something like that. But very, very good cover. This is the best one, you know, so far out of the last two we've done. Like I shouldn't say by a long shot, but it's definitely much better than number 4.
I agree. You know, the first time I saw this cover, I thought it featured Frank Brunner art, you know, but of course it is Mike Plug. It's just because of Steven's face being so prominent, and he's definitely got a Brunner-like face. If you think about Mike Plug, his faces are normally distorted, a little bit misshapen, but Steven's face here is quite handsome, like you say, Vincent Price-ish, And I agree with you wholeheartedly, Billy. This cover is a tour de force. Mike Ploog can do no wrong, especially when it comes to covers. His interiors are often dependent upon the inker, but this cover, I guess he inked himself, at least according to the research I did. And look how well that works.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes through very strongly. And then you mentioned the hand that cracks through the flagstones of the floor in this Starksboro church. That thing looks incredibly ominous and frightening. that hand is scaled, it's gnarled, the fingers are all knotted, and you know, then got these giant claws on each fingertip. Crazy man, crazy stuff. And I also like the background images, you know, of the candle flames and the children of Sligith, these subhuman people. And you know, the man in the background who seems to be a priestess of Sligith, I guess that's supposed to be Ethan Stoddart, the character from the previous issue we discussed. Although, you know, if you look at the interiors, it turns out not to be the case. We are, in fact, introduced to this priestess, right, Billy? Ibora.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, you know, Mike Ploog must have gotten different information. He might have been commissioned to do the cover based off of the events of the previous issue. So that's probably why he drew this Ethan Stoddart as the priest. Because as we know, Ethan Stoddart turned on Doctor Strange in the last issue. So, Billy, I'm in full agreement. This cover is amazing. And also, the trademark Marvel alliteration on the cover, which heralds the name of this story, The Lurker in the Labyrinth. And we'll see some more of that.
Yeah, great name.
Yeah, great name. Come the next issue, which is Marvel Premier number 6, where again we will have some alliteration in the title there. But I guess we can head on into the interiors here, Billy. Now, okay, I don't know. What do you think about the art by Irv Wesley in this issue?
Well, it, for those that don't know, it's a pseudonym. It's Sam Questkin is the artist, the penciler, I should say. And inks by Don Perlin. And I don't really care for their, you know, pencils and inks together. I'm not a huge Sam Questkin guy to begin with. I haven't seen a lot out of his work, but the stuff I have seen, it was just okay. Mm. And this, it just doesn't work for me. For most of it, probably 75-80% of the issue, it doesn't work for me. Like the splash page, you know, The Lurker in the Labyrinth, again on the splash page, like the cover. Most of it looks pretty good, but then when you look at the people that are the spawn of Sligith or whatever they were calling themselves, they look absolutely ridiculous, especially the people in the forefront.
Mm. Billy,
you know, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Doesn't work for me.
I would have to say I concur with everything you just said, that the problem is it's so cartoony that it sort of mutes the horror effect that I think Gardner Fox as the writer here strives for. Because they look cute to me, these children of Sligith. They're like cute little plush toys. I don't feel at all appalled or scared by their subhuman appearance. And I agree. So, I mean, Sam Questkin, he did do horror before. You know, he used to do a lot of art for Atlas Comics in the 60s. In the 50s, actually. 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Golden Age.
Yeah, Golden Age. So I remember his stuff being more terrifying back then. But somehow he developed a style which was more suited to children illustrations. Although I don't know if he ever did that, but this looks like a illustrated book for a children's fairy tale, you know, compilation or anthology. So I agree with you. He's not really the artist I would prefer on this, but, you know, we're treated to a fantastic artist in the next issue. So that sort of makes up for it. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to discuss both of these issues together, Billy, 5 and 6, because I realized that if we just discussed 5, I would be left, you know, with this big old hole in my heart where I'm saying I didn't get the art fix that I wanted from just talking about Marvel Premier number 5. So, but, you know, Irv Wesley, he had an interesting career. You know, he left comic books in the 60s to do some commercial art. And I think he worked for an advertising company. And then later on, he came back and did some Submariner issues. you know, in the early 70s at Marvel, which didn't look too bad. I mean, it really wasn't too bad. I've got some of them. In fact, later I'm going to be talking some Submariner during our Shop Talk segment. You can find some of his art in the Submariner Masterworks. But, you know, eventually he just opted out of comics altogether. He was never a fan favorite, I think, with the readers. But Billy, yeah. Then I want to ask you something else. This issue, I want to ask you what you think about this, because this issue features the first ever appearance, not ever, but the first appearance of the Vishanti. And that is a big deal. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Stephen calls upon them. He's weak. You know, he's going to die. So he calls upon the Vishanti, which is sort of his go-to pantheon of magical beings. And they actually appear in their, what they term as their human forms, humanoid forms, because apparently their true forms will drive anyone who looks upon them insane.
Yeah.
So they appear. And, of course, the Vishanti consists of Ashtar, who's a lady, and then Agamotto and Hogoth. You can recognize all of these names, listeners, from, you know, Stephen's frequent utterances of by the hoary host of Hogoth.
Mm-hmm. His spell casting, yep,
that's right. Now, Billy, I assumed that Hogoth, since he's called hoary, would be the lion-like humanoid entity, but it turns out that is in fact Agamotto. So you've got this blue guy, right, with these compound eyes appearing as this floating face, and then you've got Ashtar, who's this green-skinned lady, very attractive, and then you've got this lion with the fiery eyes, or this cat-like being. So, you know, I just figured that's Hogoth, because he just hairy, hoary, who knows. But it turns out that's, in fact, Agamotto's preferred guy. So what do you think of them and their visual portrayal here, Billy?
It's okay. It's not bad, but it's not great either. It's a little bit of a letdown. It's nice to see them. I'm glad they actually put like faces to the names, but the faces, maybe it's just the way they're rendered, but they don't really do a lot for me. Like the young guy looks like a lion from, you know, the Wizard of Oz or something.
Or Aslan. From
the Cowardly Lion or something here.
The Cowardly Lion. Yeah, Aslan is more heroic.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know about this.
I mean, this is a big deal, seeing the Vishanti for the first time. I would have preferred if this was Bruner or, you know, P. Craig Russell or anyone else, really, illustrating that.
Yeah. Barry Windsor Smith and in issue 3 we saw, you know, that would have been great.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. But unfortunately, that's not what we got. Still, the Vishanti appeared, and then, Billy, they can make up their minds. They vacillate between whether or not they should get involved, and then they do get involved, but they say they don't want to get involved. I found that a bit of clunky writing on Gardner mm-hmm. Fox's part. And, you know, I'm a big Gardner Fox fan. I love his Silver Age stuff, but I think here he was already sort of maybe in the doldrums. He wasn't feeling comic book writing anymore. I'm not sure. You know, I haven't read any biographies. I'm still waiting for a Gardner Fox biography to come out by, you know, one of our friends, in fact, is working on one.
Yeah.
And I'll plug that later. But I feel that he wasn't really at his best while writing Stephen Strange. He did introduce a lot of cool horror concepts, though. So I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Yeah, I think he was much more suited to write superheroes than he was the supernatural.
Yeah, or sci-fi. Yeah, superhero sci-fi. I agree. Definitely. He was good at that. But, you know, he is a self-confessed fan of the Weird Tales magazines from the 1930s and the 1920s and 1930s. So he does like his horror.
Yeah.
But, like I say, if you're a fan writing fan fiction, that's not always, you know, the best thing. You should write what you've been proven to be good at writing, which in Gardner Fox's case is science fiction. But, you know, maybe Gardner Fox fans out there are, you know, pulling their hair out by the roots because, you know, they might maintain that he's good at writing all kinds of comics. He might be. He might very well be. It's just, what I'm saying is this part of his career his writing felt a little bit awkward to me, especially here. Now, there is one good part of the plot that I did enjoy, which is all probably Gardner Fox, where he introduced, at first, Steven regaining some of his magic powers, right, Billy? And being able to beat back Sligith. Because Steven's chained on an altar, he's going to be killed. And he in his own inner monologue, he lets us know that he has no magic left. And then suddenly the Cloak of Levitation saves him. And some magic has entered back into the cloak. And then he regained some, I think it's the crystals of Sitarak, which he employs to sort of laser beam Sligith back into the darkness, which is pretty cool. But you still get the idea that it's a weak effect. You know, he's been severely depleted by the Starksboro magical leeching force. So it turns out, and I think this is a bit of a brilliant plot here, because at first it's a mystery. How can he get his powers back? The Ancient One has been aiding him from afar. And that leads into a subplot where the Ancient One is kidnapped because he has now spent his magic on helping Steven, and now he's vulnerable to his own magical foes who kidnap him. So I like that device employed by Gardner Fox. What did you think, Billy?
Yeah, for sure. That was one thing that was, you know, a bright spot here. And again, not that he's, you know, can't write or anything like that. The script is fine. But it was tough to find things about the story overall, like the concepts and the same things they were pulling from the previous issue. You know, that's still great. I love that kind of stuff. But it just it seemed very Silver Age-y to me, the way the story was told, you know. And I think that's some of those guys from the Silver Age, you know, were able to make a transition, and some guys kind of, you know, that was the end of their career then come the Bronze Age, because times are changing and things are changing, and they just, you know, they knew one way, Golden and Silver Age, how to write comic books, and that's all they knew, you know, and they didn't ever adapt or change. But I mean, this issue did bring us another really, really, really awesome thing, and I know you had to have been excited about it, the announcement of another being, an evil one.
Oh yes, of course. They name dropped him. And I don't know, Billy, have we spoken about this before? Is it your actual favorite Doctor Strange villain? Because it is mine.
He's up there. I like Shumagorath for sure. He's way, way up there. I actually like Dormammu when he's done, you know, to be someone very powerful too. I like him, not the awful thing they did to him in the movie. We'll talk about that another time.
Ouch. I was enjoying this conversation and then crashed and burned.
I'm telling you. my biggest gripe. But anyway, we'll talk about that. But
He's
up there.
Yeah, it's definitely worse than the depiction of Galactus in the Fantastic Four movie, the second one. The Dormammu depiction was even worse than that, for me, at least, as a huge Doctor Strange fan. I mean, I'm a fan of the Fantastic Four and the Silver Surfer, and of course I like Galactus, but, you know, I felt more affronted by Dormammu in the Doctor Strange movie than I was at that huge cloud-like fart in the sky. I mean, this time around they gave us a fart with a face.
Yeah, I wanted to weep after I saw that. I thought, oh.
What a wasted opportunity.
The other, you know, villain that led up to that, to me, was very weak as well. That was, you know... I liked the movie overall, but Caecilius to me was like, it was too weak.
Yeah, another wasted opportunity. Mads Mikkelsen, they could have given him a much better script, much better character arc, much better character per se. You know, they could have just created a whole different kind of character. Unfortunately, I was also not a Caecilius fan. I was a fan, though, of Mordo's kind of character. Because unlike Mordo in the comics, this is a totally different Mordo, right? Billy, but he, in fact, because he's so rigid in his belief that the laws of magic must be obeyed, when it's broken at the very end, he turns on his fellow wizards. And I kind of like that. It's much different from the comics, of course, but I think Doctor Strange 2 is going to feature a pretty epic villain in Mordo. Of course, we were hoping we'll also get Shumagorath and lots of other Doctor Strange villains, maybe Silver Dagger, who knows. But... I'm not sure. I think Mordo's going to be the big bad in Doctor Strange number 2, and I'm going to like him. Chitfell Elefiore, he's a great actor. I really like
him. Yeah, I really enjoyed him. I enjoyed him in that movie. He did really well.
Yeah, he's got what people call gravitas. You know, he's really got this presence when he walks onto the screen. And he's not a comedic actor at all. He's very serious in his delivery, but, you know, I enjoy that from him. It suits him in the role of Mordo. So sorry, we went off on a tangent, but it was a Stephen Strange tangent, so it doesn't matter.
Yep.
But getting back to Shuma Gorath, they name dropped him in this issue, and that's probably why they, at the beginning of the this comic, they said featuring concepts created by Robert E. Howard, because as we mentioned in the last Doctor Strange episode, Billy, Shuma Gorath is in fact a creation of Robert E. Howard, even though it was only a throwaway name that he, you know, mentioned. It's still something that Gardner Fox probably read, and since he was a fan of the Robert E. Howard tales, he latched onto that name. And since Marvel had all the rights to Robert E. Howard's, or to the rights of Robert E. Howard's intellectual properties in comics, they could do anything they wanted in the comics with his ideas. Gardner Fox probably happened upon that name and said, "Ooh, I like that name. Let's make a Lovecraftian creature out of him."
Yeah.
And that's what's going to happen in subsequent issues. But we'll get to that. I like the way that Roy Thomas shepherded, in his role as editor, shepherded the introduction of Shuma Gorath, because it builds, right, Billy, issue by issue. You feel the trepidation. You feel the ominous sense of some great and disturbing coming. Okay, that sounds bad.
Yep.
But this, well, the advent. Let's change that word to the advent of this apocalyptic entity. Wow.
Okay, Into the Weird's going X-rated here, people.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just going to describe that as we're weird. Yeah, we'll go some. Oh, speaking about going X-rated, Ibora. She really does it for me, Billy. I mean, I was very happy with her introduction, even though they quickly rambled out an origin for her. Gardner Fox just quickly, like, within a couple of panels, this is my origin. Because if you think about it, there's no reason for her to appear. I mean,
no.
In the previous issue, we had, you know, the Ethan Stoddart seeming to be, you know, in his new role as, betrayer. He also seemed to be leading the charge of these subhumans. But then suddenly behind the curtain, literally behind a curtain, we get introduced to Ibora as she leads Sligith towards Stephen on this altar. And I like her. I like her look. She reminds me of a Hammer villainess. Even though we didn't get a lot of female villains in the Hammer movies, she kind of reminds me of someone like that, a vampire maid intent upon, you know, some malefic errand. Yeah, so I enjoyed her. What do you think about her overall, Ibora?
I mean, I like her as a character, and I'm glad they threw a little quick origin out there for her, but I'm pretty sure this is her one and only, you know, appearance. Yes. So it's kind of like, well, I feel like if you wanted to throw an origin out there for the character, maybe you could have done a little bit more with her down the road, but
it
is what it is, I guess.
The problem is she's the priestess of these creatures who are themselves avatars or servants or disciples of Shuma Gorath, and we're talking about Sligith being the first, but then all of her, you know, masters die within these two issues, so I guess she has to find a new master. But, you know, Shuma Gorath being her ultimate, you know, ruler, I think they could have featured her again later on down the line, because she's such a great character. I really like her, you know, the way she's speaking, the way Gardner Fox, the dialogue he gave her, you know, the enunciations, the insults she levels on Stephen, and also the weird exposition that she's constantly prone to, where she says, "Oh no, is there no end to his strength? The master of the mystic arts resurfaces yet again. Can nothing defeat him?" She says that a couple of times in these two issues. But
yeah,
I like her look. You know, that dress. The evil emanating from just her appearance, her long black hair, the way she stands on a cliff where her hair is all windswept, and she even dives in at one point in time, and she pulls out a trident, Aquaman or Namor style trident from nowhere, and she's gonna, you know, savage Steven with this trident. I just love her. I don't know why. I just immediately, like, yeah, this is a cool character. So you're right. They could have done more with her down the line.
You know who she reminds me of is Barbara Steele.
Oh, Barbara Steele.
Yeah, long black hair, sexy lady. Evil in a lot of the movies. So.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a great horror actress. Black Sunday. Yeah. Nightmare Castle. Wow. And what a wonderful, you know, actress. Well, I mean, for us, Billy, I mean, these horror actresses, whenever we say they're wonderful actresses, you have these people, you know, these critics clamoring, like, you guys don't know what acting is. But, you know, in the horror vein, in mm-hmm. that line, she's definitely a standout and one of the greats.
Absolutely.
Now, Billy, another thing I wanted to ask you before we get to the next issue is I wanted to ask you about, we've got the reintroduction of Clea. And she's awakened in her apartment by a dream sent by Umar, her self-professed enemy, but also, obviously, Umar being the sister of Dormammu from the Dark Dimension, she sometimes works against mm-hmm. her big brother, or her brother. And Clea is awakened by this dream sent by Umar. And the last time we saw Clea, I think, was in Doctor Strange 182, when Steven was introducing her to New York and snow, and they were walking through Times Square, and someone threw a snowball at Steven's head, and he used a spell and changed the unfortunate prankster into a snowman. And Clea being surprised at Steven's, you know, fickle use of his magic. But still, you know... that's the last time we saw her waltzing through Times Square, very much in love with Steven and having her own apartment. Steven still, you know, remember, Billy, he went there and very formally knocked on her door and asked her to go on a date with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As human customs delegate. So then, you know, that was the last time we saw Clea, drawn by Gene Colan back then. And wow. Now, yeah. I will say something for Irv Wesley. His Clea is kind of sexy. I dig her a little bit. The way he framed her face. What do you think, Billy?
Yeah, if you look at page 18, the top, you know, left panel, she looks really good in that panel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are a couple of panels where her face seems to have gotten away from him a little bit. But, yeah, she looks really, really good in that panel up top.
Yeah. I know exactly the panel you mean. She looks really good. But mm-hmm. it could also be said that she's the kind of character and her overall design and her look that any artist can make look good. You know, any artist can render her in a very attractive light just because of her unique look. You know, the little hair, the silver-like hair with the little tufts pointing upwards in this sort of demonic little two horns and... I don't know, short-haired ladies sometimes do it for me, especially when their hair is silver or white. I don't know, Billy.
Oh, yeah.
She's just a very, very interesting character and always one of my favorites when it comes to the ladies of Marvel. But,
absolutely.
And then, Billy, I said this is the last thing I was going to ask you about this issue, but there's one more thing. Okay, Irv Wesley, one good thing I can say for him is the action panels in this issue are quite dynamic. I mean, we've got this first scene where Steven proves his fighting chops and resourcefulness when he, in fact, uses his chains that had been, you know, part of the altar to beat back Sligith. And, you know, I really felt the dynamic action, even though it's not as great as Barry Windsor-Smith or Frank Bruner, I felt the dynamism in these panels where Steven has to actually defend himself against Sligith without his magical powers. And it turns out Steven is very good at that. He's good at, in fact, resorting to fisticuffs when he needs to be. So what did you think about that, Billy? Those series of action panels where Steven bests Sligith for the first time.
Yeah, I enjoy it too, because I don't think they touch on it too much right now, but down the road they will, that, you know, for all the Wong calling Steven master stuff, that eventually Wong shows to be his master in the martial arts and is training Steven to be, you know, a good hand-to-hand fighter. And they do touch on that as the years go by. Yeah. Not so much right now, but I do like seeing that because then that does get developed. So I really do enjoy it.
That's right. Well, in these early appearances in the 70s of Dr. Stephen Strange, it turns out that he is a master of the martial arts, but that's accredited to the Ancient One also having trained him in that. You will see that in some issues of Defenders. I'm thinking specifically of the Defenders, the Avengers Defenders War, where Stephen faces off against Mantis. Mm-hmm. And Mantis, you know, compliments him on his martial arts knowledge. And Stephen does drop some info there, saying that, you know, the Ancient One also trained him in other arts. But I'm glad they retconned that to be Wong. Because when we get to the issues where Doctor Strange is fighting Dracula, and we get to the Montesi formula, you'll see Wong displaying some mad skills. Right, mm-hmm. right, Billy, do you remember? Courtesy of Gene Colan's impeccable art, of course, but still, wow. Those martial arts scenes with Wong taking on vampires, love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will say, too, I don't want to beat up on the art too bad, but there was a page where Strange is down in the depths of Sligith's sanctuary, and at one point he gets attacked by a bunch of vampire bats. And that looks pretty neat. I do enjoy that page. Oh. There's like a 6-panel page. Oh, yeah, I like that.
Yes, yes, yes. I remember when he's descending into the caverns and attacked by the vampire bats. That's a brilliant scene. And also, like you say, the illustration is great. Now, Billy, I'll end this issue by saying, by quoting a bit of Gardner Fox dialogue here, which is one of the things that made me like Ibora so much. And you remember the scene when Stephen has just, semi-defeated Sligith. He's chased him away. And then Ibora calls upon the children of Sligith to attack Stephen and tear him apart. And they're attacking him, but Stephen still feels a bit of the vestiges of the Ancient One's magic. And he calls upon the vapors of Valtor to save mm-hmm. him from this mob. And then you've got Ibora seeing the vapors approach, and she exclaims, "Great Shuma-Gorath, what new shield against my powers has that master of magic summoned up? Is there no end to his necromantic wisdoms?" Now, I don't know if Gardner Fox was laughing at himself when he was writing this, but wow. That is just so overblown, superfluous, but it's so awesome. And it's so weird. And that's one of the reasons that's my favorite bit of dialogue in this entire issue. Ibora. Wow. With their trademark verbal flourishes. So, yes, and then we end the issue by Stephen then confronting Shuma-Gorath in the caverns. And, of course,
Sligith
again. Yeah. And that's sort of their second confrontation. There's going to be a third in the beginning of the next issue. But this second one, Stephen is almost bested because he finds himself again without his magic. And then he calls upon the Vishanti. And then they say they're not going to help. And just before they disappear, they say, "Okay, we'll help." And Stephen sort of regains his full power. And wow, this is a cool battle because he calls upon, I think, the Rings of Ragador to free him from Sligith's grasp. And then he gives Sligith a beatdown. Right, Billy? I mean, the Shield of the Seraphim is employed. The Rings of Ragador again to chain Sligith. But then his magic wanes again. The brief respite he was given by the Vishanti is over. And Ibora then employs some magic of her own by standing on this windswept cliff, which is a great visual. Not very detailed, but you know, I like that effect, where she calls upon the spawns of the ocean. And she even mutters some Lovecraft speak. Nathagan Fantugan. Gazarthik Gathorak, or whatever, Gathodrak. And then the ocean, oh man, that's insane. The ocean obeys her command and floods the caverns where Stephen and Sligith are engaged in their battle. And then Sligith, of course, escapes because he seems to be able to breathe underwater. But Stephen stumbles into a crevice, and then he's trapped. And this flood is going to drown him, but it seems Ibora can't wait for that to happen. She leaps off the cliff with this trident, which, like I mentioned before, she's literally pulled from nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way she could have hidden that trident in her, in that skimpy little outfit. And she, she leaps off the cliff into the waters below and menacing Stephen in the final panel, saying that nothing can save you now, Stephen Strange. Nothing! And then we're treated to the next title of the subsequent issue, The Shambler from the Sea. So, Billy, let's do some ratings for this comic. What did you think overall, Irv Wesley's art notwithstanding? What were your impressions overall and your rating of this comic?
I enjoyed it, but I just think that the art was just okay at best. And the story, I like a lot of the concepts. I really do. I like the Lovecraftian speak that you were trying to pronounce there better you than me. But overall, it's just middle of the road for me. It's not great. It's not terrible. It's not one of the issues I really can go back to a lot. It's okay. It's not bad, but it's just okay.
Yes, the only noteworthy thing in the entire issue is the Vishanti's first appearance on the page, and that, you know, I can't think of anything else really. I do love it. Yeah,
them mentioning Shuma-Gorath too. That was awesome.
Oh, of course,
especially since with you when you know already what's happening down the road. I mean, I'm sure if you were a reader back in 1973, you thought, okay, what's this all about? If you know you didn't read any Howard, but knowing what we know comes along, that's a really good reveal. And then Kalia coming back too was another good one. Those three things, they keep it, you know, the head above water here for this issue. But if it wasn't for those three things, man, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree. Okay. So there's nothing new I can add to what you just mentioned, Billy, because I also, you know, appreciate the first mention of Shuma-Gorath and, you know, the way that Gardner Fox is structuring, you know, his introduction slowly but surely. But like you say, a throwaway issue at best. Also not one that I frequently reread. I think I've only ever reread it twice, which was the very first time I read it way back when I acquired it. I think the first time I read it was when I picked up the Doctor Strange Marvel Masterworks number 5. And then I actually bought that one before I got the actual back issue of this to fill up my old Doctor Strange run. Yeah, so I might have read it 3 times by now, but I recently reread it, of course, for the show. And it didn't impress me much then either, except for the fact that, you know, Gardner Fox employs this weird and convoluted way of speaking and the dialogue and the introduction of Ibora, but, you know, nothing's done with her down the line, so forgettable at best, this issue. So then we head on into an issue that I could almost describe as a masterpiece in art because it pairs 2 of our favorite Bronze Age artists on it, and that is Frank Brunner and Sal Buscema in Marvel Premiere number 6. Again, with writer Gardner Fox at the helm, and this time we've got Roy Thomas as the editor once more and Gaspar Saladino as the letter. Wow, a letterer. I've always loved that name, Gaspar Saladino. Yeah, he appears frequently on old Bronze Age and dare I say some Silver Age Marvel issues as a letterer. So, Billy, before we talk about the cover, I'm again going to do the synopsis. And this time around, we're treated to some more a more straightforward plot. So this synopsis will not take long at all. So bear with me, readers. Okay, here we go. Stephen manages to escape the crevice, only to be confronted by the dreaded Sligith once more. With his magics almost completely depleted, Stephen manages to slay Sligith in hand-to-hand combat by resorting to an interesting tactic. Clea and Wong, on their way to Starksboro to assist Doctor Strange, end up being captured by Ibora and the subhuman inhabitants of Starksboro, and are offered up as sacrifices to the Shambler of the Sea. Steven intervenes, but the Shambler proves too much for him until the Ancient One melds his astral form with Steven's once more, and Doctor Strange regains his full powers. After that, the Shambler is soundly thrashed by the Master of the Mystic Arts, but not before the creature recovers a mysterious chest from beneath the ruined church of Starksborough, a chest containing a sinister message of dire portent. And that's the short but sweet synopsis, Billy. So, cover. Let's talk about this cover again. Again, Mike Ploog bringing his all, bringing his best. What did you think?
Again, love it. I really, really love the visual on this creature here. The Sligith wasn't bad or anything like that, but it was just sort of a little generic, maybe I'll say.
Yeah.
Almost looked like if you would take a monitor lizard and stand it straight up like a bipedal.
Yeah.
But this creature, and especially on the cover, looks absolutely insane. It looks scary. It looks menacing. It's the only thing that's a little bizarre about the cover is Ebora is on the cover, and she looks like she's going to attack the creature instead of Doctor Strange.
Yes.
The posing is a little strange.
Exactly.
Wow, strange. A little weird. Let's not say strange, a little weird. But other than that, love the cover. It's way, way, way awesome. Love this cover.
I agree. Yeah, Ebora looks like some kind of crazed Mera from DC Comics' as Aquaman, because she seems to be unaffected by the fact that she's under the ocean. She's standing on the ocean floor. Steven looks like he's drowning, air bubbles coming out of his mouth, but Ebora's just leering and looking quite at home underneath the waves. But yeah, she doesn't look as good as she looked, I would say, the way Irv Wesley introduced her. But of course, she's a throwaway character, right, Billy, like we've said. So I guess Mike Ploog wasn't paying much attention to her. He might have not even been given an adequate description of her, or he might not have read the previous issue, who knows. But yeah, she's forgettable. But the Shambler, yeah, like you say, he's some kind of amalgamation between Cthulhu and Swamp Thing, or the Man-Thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's got this cyclopean skull, and then he's only got one eye, being a cyclops himself, and then he's got these tentacles, which almost look like snake heads emanating from his jowls. And he's got this scaled skin, but pockmarked, which gives him the sort of swamp creature effect, but yet he's not a swamp creature. He is a creature of the ocean depths. And he's got these energy bubbles floating out from his back and from the back of his head, probably caused by the spell that Steven is casting, trying to free himself from the grip of this monstrous being on the cover of Marvel Premiere number 6. So great cover overall. Again, Mike Ploog brings it. I'm hard-pressed to pick my favorite cover. I think it'll probably be this one if I had to pick between Marvel Premiere number 5 and number 6, but it's by a very narrow margin, Billy. Which one is your favorite overall between the two covers?
It would be this one, and like you said, not by a long shot or anything like that, but just because you can see the other one just has like a fist of some creature underneath the floor, and this one shows you full on what's going to happen here. And I usually like a little bit of mystery, but Ploog did such a good job with this monster here. Kind of reminds me, like you said, a little bit of Cthulhu, a little bit of the Gill Man from Creature from Black Lagoon.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's very, very good cover. Just like I said, it's the way the characters are set on the page. It looks a little bizarre with Ebora. And then if you really keep looking at it, it's a little difficult to tell it's underwater. You can see Steven grabbing his throat like he's, drowning, and see the bubbles there. But other than that, it's not super easy to tell. It almost looks like it could be like a graveyard scene or something.
Yes, good point. I mean, there's some skulls at the back there, some skeletons lying behind Ebora. And, what is supposed to be a water current effect looks more like vapors or smoke rising from the ground. From the seafloor. Yeah. So yeah, it looks like Steven himself is being suspended in some kind of invisible water spell with the rest of them just acting normally, But, I like the lettering on the introduction of the title of the issue, the Shambler, the way they lettered that, which is possibly, of course, attributed to Gaspar Saladino, a name I wish I had. And, you know, I like that, that they made it look like the letters are actually shambling on the page. And,
yeah.
And you'd think that a guy called the Shambler would be quite easy to escape or avoid, because after all, shambling lends itself to the idea that he's slow. He's slow moving, ponderous, clumsy even. But not this guy. Oh, no, no. He's quite effective under the waves and above. So Stephen's got his work cut out for him in this issue. But there's one of the Shambler's features, yes, Billy, that isn't featured prominently on the cover, but you can see some hints of it. The most distinct feature of the Shambler is not, in fact, his cranium or his head, but his fingertips. Right, Billy? He's got these apertures for fingertips, which would would make you think that he could apply them to your skin and suck the life or the bodily fluids out of you by applying these suction-like fingertips. What do you think of them? They're very horrific looking.
Yeah, it reminded me of, I can't think of the name of the episode, but there was a Star Trek episode, the original series, where there was some kind of creature that had, I think it was like hands like that, and it would like suck the moisture out of your body or something like that. It was almost like a...
Sounds familiar.
I don't know if it was a, yeah, a shapeshifter or just like mentally made you think it looked like a regular human, but it was actually some kind of creature that would suck the life out of you, and it was almost very, very similar to that. So that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I should rewatch the Star Trek TOS again. I haven't seen them in ages. And some great sci-fi concepts came from that series. So yeah, there might be a visual parallel between that creature and this one. I mean, you never know what Gardner Fox was watching, right, at the time. Then we get to the interiors, and here we see a great use of the Cloak of Levitation by Stephen. It might even be the cloak acting independently, where, you know, we're opening with the scene that we left off from in the last issue, where Ibora is about to stab Stephen to impale him on this trident, and then the Cloak of Levitation rears up and literally just wraps itself around the trident and just grabs it and pulls it out of her grasp. I found that to be great.
Yeah, I think they did a good job of that, back to the movie, especially in Endgame and the one before it there.
The Infinity War, yeah.
Infinity War, yeah. They had a good, like, with slapping Tony Stark and stuff like that.
I love that.
That I enjoyed. Yeah. That was funny.
Me too. And the cloak proves itself quite adept at, you know, combat when it actually, you know, assists them in fighting Thanos on Titan during Infinity War. I love the use of the cloak there, like stopping him from closing his fist and, you know, the cloak acting independently, interacting with Spider-Man. I love that. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And here we see the early stages of that. We've seen a lot of the Cloak of Levitation before doing similar things in previous issues of Strange, you know, of the Silver Age Stephen Strange appearances, but not to this effect. You know, of course, the cloak can help Stephen to fly, and sometimes it could even save him from dire situations without him actively willing it to. But here, the cloak sort of acts as a third limb, or I should say a fifth limb, if you count his legs.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got this trident. He leverages himself free from this crevice, and then he proceeds to swim to the surface, right, Billy? And that's when he encounters Sligith for the third and final time. Underwater, Stephen manages to take a breath before he's dragged back under. And then, since his magics are all but gone, he sees this cross, right, with the snake motif on it, which we saw in the first the Starksboro Church in Marvel Premiere number 4. And he uses it as a sort of baseball bat to knock Sligith unconscious. Now this is something, Billy, I want to ask you about. I had this in my notes. What do you think about the way Stephen then murders, or not murders, but kills Sligith?
I think it's funny. I don't think I don't think it makes a lot of sense, but it was hilarious. I saw it. You see this crazy cross laying there with a snake wrapped around it, and Stephen's like, "That cross, it was washed up from below by the ocean currents," and he just picks it up and waffles away.
And the sound effect is zock. That's not the last time we'll see the sound effect from presumably Gaspar Saladino. Wow, I love that name. But anyway, then Sligith just ends up murdering Or I should say, Steven ends up murdering Sligith by literally saying, "Oh, even a fish can drown in water if its gills are held shut." And Sligith is like a fish, in that respect at least. So Steven digs his fingers into Sligith's neck. And Steven Strange then basically suffocates Sligith while he's unconscious by closing his gills. And I love the caption box that Gardner Fox put there on that panel. It says, "Cat-like, the Lord of Necromancy pounces and his hands close tight on Sligith's gills." And that's it for Sligith. He's dead. And then we see this progression of panels, Billy, where Sligith sinks beneath the waves, his tongue lolling from his mouth, dead to the world. He's been vanquished, and he sinks to the bottom. And at that precise instant, you have a doorway underneath a giant rock formation opening, and we see our first look at the interior. Well, at the first look inside the comic, at least. We've seen him on the cover of the Shambler from the Sea. And a great visual, again, by this time Frank Brunner, of course, assisted by Sal Buscema. And here you see his fingertips prominently featured, where he shambles, pardon the pun, from this hideout that he had beneath the ocean waves. Now, Billy, I don't know about the next part of the comic. I found this very strange and jarring. Suddenly, Wong and Clea arrive in the car in Starksboro. That's how they went, from New York to Starksboro, and then they meet a completely ancillary and, in my mind, unnecessary character in this guy called Johnny Frames, who, I mean, you'd think it would be Ethan Stoddard, but this guy, Johnny Frames, he just comes up to them in the car as they arrive in Starksboro, and he says, "Oh, please help me, my name's Johnny Frames, I must get aid to free the girl I love. Deborah and I have to be married, but I begged her not to come back to this wicked town. She insisted, and now she's in the grip of some fiendish spell." That's exactly Ethan Stoddard's problem. And yet this is a totally new character that they're introducing. And there's even a caption box, Billy, that says, "A predicament not unlike that faced by Ethan Stoddard in issue number 4, Roy." So why did Roy Thomas as an editor allow this? Couldn't they have introduced Ethan again, saying that, "Oh, now the grip, since Steven has, bested Sligith, the grip of, magic or brainwashing or whatever that's been plaguing Ethan has disappeared and he's himself again." They could have done that. But of course, as we know, Ethan Stoddard was a pawn of, Sligith and, the Shumagorath disciples all along. Because, he had literally been created to entrap Steven. So maybe that's the reason. I don't know. What do you think, Billy?
I don't know how far I want to get into it, because that's a mighty Marvel misstep for me. Huge. I couldn't take it.
Why introduce him at all? Why?
Yeah, that's the only thing about this issue that I just, if I had hair, I would pull it out.
Yes. I mean, Johnny Frames. Come on, Johnny Frames. I mean,
yeah, it's the stupidest name ever.
Yeah, that's right. If I recall correctly, he's completely missing in the subsequent issue, which is issue number 7, which we'll talk about down the line. He just disappears off the page. So there's no reason at all why they should have included him in this issue, other than him being a third sacrifice, that Ibora will offer up to the Shambler later on. So yeah, Mighty Marvel misstep indeed. A huge misstep. That's one small step for us, Billy, but one Mighty Marvel missteps for Marveldom.
You're not kidding.
And then, we've got this scene where Wong and Clea go up against, and Johnny Frames, I should say, go up against the children of Sligith, where they're captured and they're taken to the altar by Ibora and the children so that they can sacrifice them again on this clifftop, which seems to be the favorite hangout, spot of Ibora. She probably brought all her dates there, this cliff with this altar. And then she offers Clea, thinking that Steven has been killed by Sligith, she offers up Clea and Johnny and then, of course, Wong to the Shambler. But you'd think that, wow, her allegiances shift very quickly, because at first she was a priestess of Sligith. Now he's dead. Now she immediately turns towards the Shambler. But, you know, I guess she's got them all at her beck and call, Billy, because she's ultimately working for Shumagorath, who controls them as his disciples. So it's not too much of a stretch. Still some clunky writing again on Gardner Fox's part. Stephen exits the ocean fresh from his victory over Sligith, and then he hears again this Gardner Fox chanting, Gnatha Cthul Merak. And then he flies up to the top of the mountain and he sees the Shambler coming for his three friends. Now, this is another misstep for me. Clea, being well-versed in the mystic arts, at least she's a student of Doctor Strange, she might not have gained her full powers at this time, but she is taken so easily, and basically she's just a foil here, Billy. There's nothing that she can do. She just screams and cowers and, you know, trembles at the sight of these things that Stephen has to save her from, and yet she arrived to save him. Which I would have thought Gardner Fox would have taken advantage of and shown us some of Clea's, you know, independence and given her more agency here. But again, Marvel missteps in this sense. But Stephen then commences to combat Sligith, and he's quite easily beaten in their first skirmish, right, Billy? The Shambler seems to have some kind of optic beam, much like Cyclops, who takes his namesake from the Shambler, probably, because the Shambler himself is a giant Cyclops. And this optic beam proves too much for Stephen, until it turns out he is again aided by the Ancient One. And then events progress very quickly. He takes out the Shambler quite easily with his full powers restored. He employs twice, I think, Billy, the Demons of Danak spell.
Yep.
Which is pretty cool. I mean, it seems very effective. And then that leads the Shambler to flee and try to retrieve this ancient box, which also makes no sense. Why not just leave the box there? And yet, the Shambler going to retrieve the box when he's on the outs or when he's, you know, on the ropes against Stephen makes no sense, because this allows Stephen the chance to kill the Shambler and then take the box. Which wouldn't have been done if the Shambler didn't first go to locate the box. So that part made no sense, Billy. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I like what it leads to in the next issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, right here in this part, it's crazy. It makes about as much sense as Johnny Frames. So okay, moving on.
I mean, at best, Johnny Frames is not even a framing device at all for the people of Starksboro. We had that in Ethan Stoddard. We didn't need him in this issue at all. No, it's crazy. But, you know, it turns out the Ancient One again saved Stephen Strange. He's being, of course, being held captive by the Children of Ka'u, the Shadow Men, sorry, of Ka'u. And from his prison cell, he manages to send his astral form, fuses with Stephen, and Stephen regains his full powers. And then there's this great panel. I think it's on the very final page of the issue where the Ancient One's astral form leaves Stephen by way of his head, by way of the fontanelle on top of his head, which he probably doesn't have anymore because he's not a baby. But still, that's how the Ancient One exits Stephen's form. And it's a great panel, right, Billy? The way Frank Bruner and probably also Sal Buscema drew that. And then we see that the contents of this chest is revealed to be a map in stone of Stonehenge in England, and that is their next destination, because immediately Stephen gets this premonition saying that he senses dire perils, forgotten abysses of forgotten fears, and chasms of primordial horrors gape wide to destroy our world. We must travel to England now. Again, Gardner Fox pulls a Roy Thomas and even pulls a Stan Lee and puts some, you know, heavy-handed writing, you know, with some flourishes there onto the page. But overall, this issue is a vast improvement over the previous one, right, Billy?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. There's no denying that.
Yeah. I'll rate this one much higher, probably mostly because of the art, but also because of the more straightforward story that Gardner Fox tells here, even though there's some weird plot holes along the way. Johnny Frames, you know, being the greatest of them, but there's also some smaller ones. I think it concludes satisfactorily in the end, Billy. So well done to the creative team on this one. This one is one that I will refer back to, you know, every now and again. I will reread it just because of the Shambler and because of the epic battle between Stephen, you know, and the Shambler.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, Billy, any other notes or any other things you wanted to mention about these two issues before we wrap it up?
Just one quick thing about this issue here specifically, that there is some info on a couple of different pages that say, and he's not a huge name if you don't know, you know, Silver Age stuff or even maybe even Golden Age he might have been around, but Ralph Reese, he inked the first couple of pages, and you can tell if you look at the first couple of pages and then look at the rest of the story,
right,
you can tell it looks like it was inked by someone differently. Because I remember looking at that first splash page and Steven looks okay, but Ibora looks a little bizarre. And then you look at the next page and you think, okay. But then from there on out, Steven, like you look at Steven's face, it's different. It's, you can tell it was inked, you know, by someone else then, but still not too bad. But like you said, a huge improvement over the issue before.
Right. Good points, Billy. Good points all. All right. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Missteps. So stay tuned, listeners. Don't go away.
I tell you, from its size and its appearance, this thing came from outer space.
Hey, slow down. Johnny?
All right, we're back with Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Missteps. So, Billy, I'll let beauty go before age. So, you're first. Can you tell us what did you think is worth mentioning in the Bronze Age Brilliance section?
Okay, so for Bronze Age Brilliance, the concepts here that they're using, I absolutely love. The cults, you know, Howard and Lovecraftian monsters, creatures, whatever you want to call them, love them, absolutely love them. Those things, you could write stories about those and draw them in comic books all day long, and I'm there. I'm going to read them. Those things are just incredible. And then you get Ancient One appearance, Clea appearance. You just can't go wrong with those kind of things there. I love them. Absolutely. Both issues, even with one being a little weaker with artwork, still had those same set of core things, you know, about them that I can look at all day. I can just turn pages in comics and look at those all day long.
Oh, that's a good one, Billy. Dare I say it, a brilliant Bronze Age Brilliance entry. For me, I was tempted to at first say the introduction of the Vishanti visually, but like we say, it left me wanting, you know, because it's not as great as it could have been. After I was speculating a bit about it, I thought it would have been so much better if Barry Smith or Frank Bruno did it, or even Gene Colan. You know, I would have loved it if Colan was the first one to do a visual of the Vishanti. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go with that. In fact, I'm going to go with something similar to yours, Billy. I'm going to mention the Cthulhu-like mythos that has been established here by Marvel, but it's separate from the actual Cthulhu mythos because they've created analogs of all Lovecraft's entities and cosmic monsters and gods and so forth. And I like them. I'm not thinking it's derivative at all, even though you'd think it would be. It's, in fact, something completely new and completely on its own. If you think about something like the Shambler, he could be Nyarlathotep and Dagon all amalgamated, but you know, he's not a completely standalone Lovecraft character where you could think, okay, this is definitely taken or stolen from Lovecraft. No, they're combining the ideas that Lovecraft had with probably some ideas of his editor August Derleth and also some Clark Ashton Smith and all of that, and Robert E. Howard, of course, and they're creating an entirely new Marvel mythos. as we would later learn in comics like Spider-Woman and later issues of Doctor Strange, when we talk about the Darkhold and we get more into the history of the Vishanti, there is a Marvel Cthulhu-like figure called K'thon. And he's completely separate from Shumagorath. My point is there, you can't really narrow it down to saying that, oh, he's an analog of Cthulhu or this one's an analog of Dagon. They did sort of create their own Marvel Cthulhu mythos that's completely standalone. And of course, it would be remiss of me to not mention Ibora. You know, the evil priestess analog or archetype has always been a favorite of mine. And she definitely fills that role more than adequately. So yes, definitely, I concur with you, Billy. The concepts, that's my Bronze Age brilliance. And how about Mighty Marvel missteps? There's quite a few. We've got a lot to pick from.
I mean, honestly, do we need to say more other than Johnny Frames here? I don't know.
Yes.
Oh,
I was tempted to say the quick and rushed origin of Ibora, but no, Johnny Frames takes the cake.
Yeah, that's the number one. I mean, in the first issue, number 5, the artwork is wildly inconsistent. It's all over the place. The followers of Sligith, like you said, they look like some kind of a Muppet or something. They look absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
Even the doc looks different from one page to another in issue 5. So that's a huge misstep there for sure. But yeah, definitely Johnny Frames takes the cake for me. I mean, there was only one thing that I wanted to say is when he says that he's looking for his girlfriend and, oh, you need to help me. And he says, Deborah. So are we to assume you remove the D and it's Ibora, that's his girlfriend?
Wait a minute. I didn't see that, Billy. I did not.
They never say specifically, but I just thought to myself, Deborah, and you lose the D and it's Ibora. It's the same thing. So I'm thinking, I'm assuming that's her.
Because he did mention that his fiancée, his possible betrothed, was corrupted by evil and changed, changed by this evil that permeates Starksboro. Wow, that's a good point, Billy. I did not see that at all. I feel blind here. I feel like Matt Murdock, and not in a courtroom. I feel like I'm totally out of my depth here. So okay, that was a good, very good, a catch that you made there, because that sounds very plausible to me. I'm completely going to support that theory of yours and saying that Ibora is Johnny Frames' girlfriend, corrupted by Starksboro. So, okay, that might make his introduction seem less clumsy or less needless, I should say. But still, you know, they never tie that together. Maybe that's some kind of a visual clue or some clue in the dialogue left to the reader by Gardner Fox, inserted without Roy Thomas's knowledge. Who knows? It might have been some little bit of, not an Easter egg, but a bit of a riddle left up to our interpretation. So I enjoy that. I'm glad you pointed that out. I didn't see that on my own. So for me also, the introduction of Johnny Frames, but I want to make it more general and say that the frequent plot holes and, introduction of unnecessary things could all be attributed to Gardner Fox's outline or his script that he came up with, because there's just so many of them. Overall, it works because it gives us Doctor Strange involved in mystical battles, which is what I'm looking for, and it gives us some real sense of palpable danger, because you feel like Doctor Strange is in fact fighting for his life at many points in the story, but there's just too many, let's use our own term, missteps in when I'm talking about the plot overall. So I'm going to attribute the missteps to the clunky writing of Gardner Fox. And this might have been a misstep that I've mentioned before in regards to Gardner Fox in the Bronze Age. I can't remember previous episodes. It must be. Yeah, so Billy, mine is more general, more broad, but yeah, I'm going to say that. And Johnny Frames is definitely a direct result of Gardner Fox's bad writing in this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think too, this is to go back to our last episode on Doctor Strange, this even shows you how much better a writer for this genre specifically Archie Goodwin is.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah, he was way, his script was way tighter than this. Yeah. He was much better suited for this kind of a storytelling. So I kind of wonder, I thought, oh man, I wonder if he was just busy or like he couldn't have written these last two issues and kept going after issue four. But, you know, not that it was bad, but
yeah,
he would have been better suited for this for sure.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. So, oh, that's our Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Mistips out of the way. Short and sweet, right, Billy? We didn't have a lot of variety here because basically we agreed on both of these sections. We had the same ideas, vaguely, but still, you know, there's nothing more that I could say because it's so apparent, you know, the brilliance. And it's so apparent when it comes to the missteps that it's hard to not pick what we picked.
Mm-hmm.
But that leads us into our next segment, Billy, which is Shop Talk. So let's get to it.
Let's go.
Yes, now.
Attention.
All right, we're back with Shop Talk. And there's a lot to talk about, Billy, because the last time we recorded was, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. And during that time, of course, we've read a lot. We've watched some things. Things have happened, and especially in comicdom as a whole. So I've got a few things to talk about. But, of course, I'll let you go first this time around. What have you got for Shop Talk this week?
Well, one thing I realized... Of course, we all have our favorite creators, writers and inkers and pencilers and stuff like that. But every once in a while, I'll get so absorbed in one certain title or genre or something like that, that I almost, I shouldn't say forget, but I do have a terrible memory, forget about other creators. And when we did the Ghost Rider episode a couple weeks ago, that really got my interest peaked again in Tom Sutton. And I know that's a creator you really like his work as well, his artwork. He's a fantastic artist. So I thought to myself, I think I remember him doing, you know, some Marvel work, but then also some work at Charlton. So I went digging, and that's upcoming blog post of mine is going to be Tom Sutton's work, but all the stuff that I own of his from Charlton. And it is just incredible stuff. I mean, his work, I think, you know, we talked off mic a little bit how, you know, he looks like he was influenced or maybe looks like a few different artists. But when he pencils and inks his own work, you know, if it's Sienkiewicz or I'm trying to think of who else, but, you know, we mentioned a few different names, but he still has a pretty distinct style of his own. But he does have, you know, some influences and in other people he kind of looks like. But he's definitely a guy that anybody out there, you know, especially his horror work, you really need to look out for it. Because if you can find anything with his name on it, definitely, definitely look for it. Tom Sutton.
Yeah, definitely. I think last time we mentioned he did a lot of work for Charlton, but also then later on for DC, still in the horror vein. He did a lot of issues mm-hmm. of Secrets of the Sinister House, did a lot of House of Mystery, House of Secrets, and in fact had that, well, fan favorite run on Andrew Bennett, I, Vampire, in the later issues of House of Mystery, shortly before... That title was cancelled. A dark day indeed. But, you know, he's great. Like you say, not a lot of artists that you can compare him to because his style is so distinct. But, of course, Mike Ploog and Bernie Wrightson, you know, they come to mind when you talk about Tom Sutton. I sort of label them as under the same banner of the grotesquerie horror artists. You know, they're not mm-hmm. grotesque themselves. I mean, their art, you know, is good at portraying these disturbing and inhuman-like figures, which adds to their horror. You know, the effect that they generate is just amazing. And Tom Sutton, yeah. with his Creepy Things, which was collected a couple of years ago by Craig Yeo under the, you know, the publishing imprint that he established about more than 10 years ago now, called the Archives of Horror. You know, the Chilling Archives of Horror. They've got a collection, Creepy Things, but it's not in print anymore. I think you could still find it on eBay, although it's a little bit pricey because it's so rare now. Still worth picking up. I think you can get a digital copy of it on Comixology. And that's a great way to get it. But also, like you say, Billy, you have to troll the back issue bins. You have to search for eBay sales, and then you can find lots of his Charlton stuff. Because that's where he really, I think, came into prominence with his short tales of horror in, you know, issues like Scary Tales, you know, the Many Ghosts of Dr. Graves, Ghostly Haunts, and Creepy Things. So I love him. I love this guy. He's on the same level for me as Wrightson and Mike Ploog, you know, in terms of when it comes to horror artists. Richard Corbin, you know those guys. So I'm looking forward to your blog post, Billy, and that's at magazinesandmonsters.com.
Yep.
Okay, so correct. I can't wait. I can't wait to read that because a huge Sutton mark. And I think I'll post some images as well with regards to Sutton on Into the Weird as it pertains to what he did for Marvel, Doctor Strange, and so forth. But I'll leave the horror Charlton stuff to you, you know, on Magazines and Monsters. So listeners, check that out.
Yeah.
That's bound to be a great post, Billy. Thanks for thinking of that.
Yeah, he did. He did have like a few issue run on Doctor Strange title as well. I think it was in the 20s or 30s. Yes. The issues.
Yeah, he did like three issues, I think. And of course, Marvel. You know, whenever Doctor Strange heads into horror territory, you know, fighting, you know, these otherworldly creatures or vampires or something, they would call Sutton, a guy like Sutton. They would have him on standby or, you know, ask him at least, because that's what he's good at rendering and putting on the page.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now online, and he did about 7 issues in the late 70s, like 78, 79. He did 7 issues in the late 20s and early 30s issues of Doctor Strange. Yeah, look it up for sure.
That's good more stuff. Than I remember. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's awesome. We'll get to those in the future, right, Billy? I'm looking forward to talking to him, and then we'll get back to Sutton again. Once we read him again, our love for him will resurface once again. But yeah, definitely everyone check out Billy's blog, Magazines and Monsters, for some Sutton love. And then, Billy, what have I been doing? Well, I first want to tell you something that I almost did yesterday. Spider-Man Far From Home started screening here in Taipei. And yesterday I had some free time in the morning. So I was still recovering from my bronchitis, so I wasn't feeling up to recording. But I thought, hey, I'd watch a movie and I want to see Spider-Man Far From Home before, you know, all the crowds do. But then it turns out that, you know, my daughter, she's graduating from kindergarten next week, and I'm one of the sort of the chaperones, and we had to show up for a rehearsal at her school yesterday morning. So I was all set, I was ready to buy the ticket, I was standing in line at this small theater near our house, which is never busy, and ready to watch the first morning screening of Spider-Man, which is a Wednesday here in Taiwan. And then I got the call from my wife saying, hey, did you remember you need to be at the rehearsal of my daughter's graduation? I'm like, oh, damn. Oh, man. But, you know, of course, that's more important than a movie. But still, I that was almost my own personal Marvel misstep there, forgetting about that. So I couldn't watch Spider-Man Far From Home. And, you know, looking at my schedule, I won't be able to watch it until at least 3 weeks hence. So yeah, I almost did that. But in terms of, you know, how the movie's been doing, I've read some favorable reviews, and it looks like it's quite good. But there's also been some people on Twitter who say it's an affront to their love of Spider-Man. But of course, I ignore the negative comments and sort of focus on the positive comments until I can actually see it for myself. And then I might interject with, you know, any negative opinions I might have. But, you know, I won't break it down. I'm definitely going to go watch it. How do you feel about the movie? Are you even going to see it, Billy, or you don't feel any need to?
From what I've seen preview-wise, I'm not too worked up to go see it. But I will say this. I still haven't seen Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh.
And it's really gnawing at me because I haven't heard one negative thing about it. Everybody is raving about it, and I want to see this movie. Now, I did see someone mention and said it was on Netflix.
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
I think last week.
So I will have to look for that.
Yeah, last week.
I'll have to look for that.
Yeah, Netflix released it about a week ago, and you know, I've since watched it again, my second time around, and it's still great. Probably even better than the first time around I watched it, because you get to see some of the Easter eggs you missed. You get to appreciate more of the character nuances and the dialogue, you know, because you've got something to fall back on, and now you're just it's kind of like, you know, when you first saw Star Wars way back when, right? Repeat viewings makes you appreciate it more. There's many dozens of movies I can compare it to that you know, see a second time around and it's better than the first time around. This is definitely one of those, Billy. So yeah, you definitely have to see it, probably with the family as well. It's a very family-oriented movie. It's got a strong message about, you know, family and sticking up for each other, and also about belonging. A much better message than the movie Shazam conveyed to me this year. I think Into the Spider-Verse is a more family-friendly movie. So definitely see that if you can. But in terms of...
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try to watch it, yeah.
Yeah, you have to, man. In terms of reading, though, I've been recently, for some reason, I don't know why, I've been reading a lot of Submariner comics. Now, I don't own a lot of Submariner single issues. I used to own some Bronze Age Submariner issues from the 70s, but, you know, I think some of them were subject to what I spoke to off mic once, Billy, you know, the great mold incident of South Africa, where, you know, I opened up a trunk of my old comics, and they were all moldy and messed up because of some water leakage that we had in South Africa in the mid-90s. So, you know, I lost a couple of comics to that, a couple of hundred. But, you know, also I got rid of some. But I'm a huge fan of Submariner. But the reason why I didn't hold on to the issues themselves was they were in terrible condition. So I opted for buying the Masterworks. And, you know, I started buying from the very first Masterworks. So I've got 7 of the Submariner Bronze Age Masterworks. But then I've also recently acquired the 3 Golden Age Submariner Masterworks. And,
wow.
Okay, the Bronze Age stuff is weird and wacky, but this, of course, the Golden Age, man, there you get into the real craziness of the Submariner's character. So, of course, he's wildly inconsistent, depending on the writer, of course. You know, and but a great character, and one of the original Supermen, if you know, the first invasion of superheroes that came right after Superman was introduced, the Submariner, and then, you know, the Human Torch being 2 of the very first Marvel characters. And you know, those stories are, of course, very dated. There's lots of racism. There's lots of, you know, maltreatment of women, and you know, dodgy ethics employed by the writers during that time, and horrible.
Yeah, those comics were violent. Like, if you're not ready for those, get ready. He's like crushing people's heads and drowning people and stuff. He's a maniac.
He drowns all of Manhattan at one point in time. But yeah, so, you know, I would recommend that, though, as an artifact, you know, of the times. It's definitely worth reading, and it's so silly but so fun, and those Masterworks did a great job of reprinting it. But then, you know, my real love is, of course, for Bronze Age Submariner, because you and I both, Billy, are a fan of the Defenders, and I think nowhere is Namor more regal, more arrogant, more of a dick than he is in the pages of the Defenders, and that's just because of Steve Gerber, of course, writing him that way, but also some, you know, sometimes Engelhardt and all of the writers, really, because Namor, that's his character. You know, he is the ultimate asshole, and but yet full of pride and regal at the same time. And, you know, the Defenders, but basically all of them were written like that. Stephen Strange, even, you know, we've spoken about that before. He's also a grade A douche in the pages of the Defenders. But it's all in good fun, and Namor himself in the Bronze Age was like that, of course, and I loved it. I even loved the supervillain team-up issues he did with Dr. Doom, which was also in the Bronze Age, and I've got that collection. And I've got none of the original issues, though, but I love rereading them. And I don't know why I glommed onto Namor recently. It's just, I think I saw in my shelf a slew of hardcovers that I had not read yet. I've only read, like, snippets of them. So I decided to start from the beginning. So I started from, this is just during the last 3 weeks, I started from the Marvel Masterworks number 1 of Namor in the Bronze Age, and I read all the way through to number 7. And I think there's even a number 8 that I've yet to acquire. You know, when Namor sported that little blue, you know, attire of his with those fins under his arms.
Oh, yeah.
I've yet to acquire Marvel Masterworks number 8. I'll probably have to look for that on eBay or somewhere. But I hope it's not too pricey. The first ones are quite expensive by now, but luckily I bought them when they weren't. You know, so that's what I've been doing, Billy. I've been brushing up on old Namor, and there's lots of stuff in those issues that are questionable, but very, very fun when it comes to, if you just want to have fun and immerse yourself in the Bronze Age and in some kind of mythology, you know, of Atlantis and you know, all the characters in Namor's world, then I would recommend that if you can. I mean, if you can't buy it in physical copies, it's definitely on Comixology and Comixology Unlimited, and of course Marvel Unlimited. So it's easy to read those things. And as a treat, also check out All Winners Comics, which has two, I think, or three. Wait. Let me see. How many do I have here on my shelf? Oh, no, there's 4 masterworks of the Golden Age All Winners. Now, that is basically the invaders from the 1940s. And that's Bucky and Toro and the Human Torch and Cap.
Torch, yeah.
Yeah, and then even the very first iteration of the Vision. And, you know, they're all there, Spitfire. So read those and enjoy them for what they were. Of course, don't take any of their sensibilities to heart and bring it into the 21st century. Leave that at home. But, you know, if you want a look back into a more violent age of comics, definitely give the Submariner a try. And I hope we can discuss him on future episodes, Billy. There's some wacky Submariner issues.
Particularly for sure.
Bronze Age.
God, yeah.
There's particularly one I want to discuss featuring Namor meeting a version of the Beatles in a yellow submarine. Written by, you guessed it, Steve Gerber.
It had to be.
So we'll get to that. Definitely. So, Billy, that's my shop talk done with. Anything else you want to add? Or
no, I'm going to, though, when we move into our next segment, use that as a good segue, the content in those comics. So we can just roll right into there when you're ready.
Okay, let's do that. So I'm going to play a quick promo, listeners, and then we'll be back with Get Off My Lawn.
Warlord Worlds,
a fan podcast devoted to the comics of writer and artist Mike Grell, including The Warlord, John Sable, Green Arrow, Star Slayer, and Shaman's Tears.
I'm Ruth.
And I'm Darren.
Please join us as we discuss the stories, characters, and art in the many excellent comics from writer and artist Mike Grell.
Special episodes feature interviews with Mike Grell himself.
And special segments feature great guests discussing the Legion of Superheroes.
Listen at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube.
Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or visit warlordworlds.com.
Warlord Worlds is part of the Rad Adventures Network at radadventuresnetwork.com.
All right, listeners, this is our segment where we air our grievances. You know the drill. Get off my lawn. So, Billy, I'll let you go first again. Is there anything you want to complain about? Or not complain about, just something you want to vilify?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is coming from, you had mentioned the Golden Age Submariner and some of the content in the stories being, you know, very outdated, very... You know, there's some racial things and all that stuff. And, you know, you and I and pretty much all the people, you know, we come in contact with on a daily basis, we know that stuff is best left in the past. You know, we don't need that stuff in 2019. But I really get upset when the comic book companies, and it's happened a couple of times, and I'm pretty sure it was DC lately, where they were going to reprint certain material and people got up in arms about it. And then they pulled it. And that drives me crazy. Because I think to myself, hey, look, anybody with a brain in their skull knows what racism is and what racism is not. And yes, some of those things work. So either just don't buy it Or, hey, put like a warning on the front of it. You know what I mean? If you want to have something on the front that says, hey, you know, there's some objectionable material in here that, you know, if you're sensitive toward that kind of stuff, you might not want to pick this up. That's all you need to do. But to pull that off of there, and, you know, off of, like, I think some of the things were even in Diamond solicited. And then, oh, they quick pulled them. You know, that drives me crazy. I think to myself, come on, people, look. If you don't want to watch something or buy something, then don't watch it. Don't buy it. You don't need to protest and go crazy and threaten people and go wild here. Like keep it in check, man. It's all going to be okay. It's just comic books.
That's right. I mean, I agree. I have to concur with you, Billy, because I enjoy reading dated material because that's the way you can learn from the past. I mean, you know, if I... When I was in a kid growing up, you know, if I hadn't read horribly racist stuff, if I hadn't read things that were so bad, so racist that they were cringeworthy, I wouldn't have been able to say that it's wrong, if you know what I mean,
yeah.
Right? So,
yeah.
You know, of course, there were publications that really opened my eyes. Like, you know, I've spoken about it on Into the Weird before. Luke Cage, you know, and 2080s Strontium Dog, you know, Johnny Alpha, they really opened my eyes towards racism because they were more forward, they were more blatant about it. But not so much Luke Cage, but, you know, the fact that Luke Cage was a hero and he was in Harlem or in Hell's Kitchen. No, in Harlem, right? Yeah, Harlem. And things were so bad and, you know, he was a champion of the people. It made me think, you know, they're cool. These people are cool. You know, you know, the movies from the 70s featuring black characters, you know, like Jim Kelly, and even though it was blaxploitation, it made me love them. It made me love those characters. They were cool. I wanted to be like them, you know, but I wouldn't have had that context if I didn't read these horribly racist stuff on the other side of the fence. So now, if you can reprint stuff that has those concepts in them, and you read them, and you could appreciate and understand that, you know, now we are not like that. We've come such a long way. Then it's for the best, I think. You know, rather than just blanketing all of that stuff, erasing them from memory, we should keep that as a historical part of our culture in order to, in fact, learn from it and improve upon it. So any comic scholar will benefit from having those things reprinted. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and I mean, like ignoring something or trying to erase something doesn't mean it didn't happen, you know? It's just, I don't know. And the one thing that really made me think of this was a friend of mine on Facebook, the guy that holds the weekly sales. I post them all the time. You've seen them, where he sells a lot of Golden Age and Silver Age books and things like that. He had posted an old Captain Marvel comic, and he'll put on a comic from back in the day and then tell you what the story was behind the comic. And it was one where there was a very racist character that would appear in the Fawcett comics, Captain Marvel. And there were people that went to Fawcett and said, hey, like, this is, you know, offensive. Like, you need to stop doing this. And eventually, a few issues later, they did, once it became like a huge deal. And, you know, the guy went on to say about how, you know, it was a good thing that they weren't going to tolerate racism.
Yeah.
Well, didn't some weasel report him to Facebook, and he got kicked off there for a day or two because of putting that picture of a comic book on there. And then the guy, I don't know if whoever reported him didn't read the text or didn't care, and saying about, you know, hey, it was a good thing that, you know, people were seeing racism for what it was and how horrible it is. And even the superheroes were against it then. You know, they thought, yep, that's not right, and we should even reflect that in our books. But then somebody reports them. It's like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
No, it's crazy. It's crazy. No, that's just ridiculous. I mean, yeah, at least read the article or read exactly what the guy wrote. You know, don't just infer from what you're seeing and immediately act upon it. You know, make sure you're doing the right thing. Double check yourself. You know, take 2 seconds. You know, look at what you're going to be doing before you post or complain, because, you know, some people genuinely try to make a change. They try to make a difference by you know, making you aware of things that you weren't aware of before, and I appreciate that. But
you know,
Billy, every now and then you'll find something that does surprise you. Ever, like a couple of years ago, I think I bought through Tomorrow's Publishing. I bought the Fawcett Companion. You know, and you just spoke about Fawcett just now, and you know, Fawcett even so far back as the early 40s, I'm stumbling over my words again. In the early 40s, they had guidelines, and that's reprinted in that, you know, Fawcett book by Tu Morris, where the guidelines state that you shall not, because they did have a character who was like a sidekick, an unofficial sidekick of Captain Marvel, who was this African-American character who was drawn in a terribly racist way. And a few issues after he debuted, Fawcett took, you know, stopped printing this character, stopped using him, because they soon realized what they were doing. They were just perpetuating a stereotype. And then the Fawcett guidelines were that at no time shall a writer or artist working for Fawcett portray racist stereotypes or use ethnic slurs. So, you know, a company like Fawcett, even way back then, they were already on the right side of things, saying that we should be more inclusive. We should be more sensitive mm-hmm. towards racial issues. And, you know, they yeah. couldn't always succeed because, you know, they were constrained by their own, you know, social limits, but they did make an attempt. And I commend that for, commend them for that. So well done for Fawcett there and some other companies too back in the day.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly the same character I'm talking about.
Is that the same?
Yep, it is. Yeah, and it drove me crazy. I thought he was trying to do something good. And even, like, let's say you did read what he posted and the cover still bothered you that he even put that on there. Like, if you're somebody's friend, message them and say, hey, that still kind of bothers me. And then, you know, to have some dialogue, talk with the person about it, and then they can really, you know, get into some dialogue and let you know that, like, hey, you know, I'm not trying to offend you or anyone else by putting it on there. I'm just trying to make people aware and, you know, hey, this is how things were and this is how they shouldn't be. You know, we need to move away from that and always stay away from that kind of stuff. But oh, it drove me crazy. I just wanted to find a wall and just start hitting my head against it.
I don't blame you, Billy. I don't blame you. Nothing wrong with a bit of self-mutilation for a good cause every now and then. But, you know, Billy, in terms of what I wanted to bring to the table here for Get Off My Lawn, it's just a quick note. And that is not really so much as a complaint as a lament for the demise of Vertigo over at DC Comics. We've seen the end of Vertigo now come and gone twice, but the first time it wasn't official. This time it's official. And Vertigo, after their second attempt to galvanize the line, had failed, I think, sales-wise, and also, you know, they had hit a creative slump, and now they're officially over and done with. So DC has canceled the Vertigo line, and I just wanted to mention that because even though this has nothing to do with the Bronze Age, you know, our Get Off My Lawn segments sometimes veer into different territories in comics and fandom. And I just want to say that I will always remember Vertigo fondly, and it was a great force in my life early on in the 90s, and got me back into reading new comics with a passion. I had always been collecting back issues, but I had fallen off buying anything new in the early 1990s. And then, you know, Vertigo was there for me at the right time, right place. I ended up, you know, my love for horror, at least, you know, was completely renovated or redone. And I saw the world with hopeful eyes again, at least for the horror genre and also for science fiction and so forth. So Vertigo has, you know, been a very important part of my comic book reading experience. And I'm sad to see that they are gone, but we will always have them and remember them with fondness. So Billy, what are your memories of Vertigo?
Well, I know a lot of comics professionals have been mentioning, you know, the passing of Vertigo here and how much it meant to them. And a guy I follow on Twitter, J.M. DeMatteis, who, you know, is a brilliant writer. Love and him. Seems like one of the nicest guys ever in the industry. Him and a bunch of other professionals could not lump enough praise on Karen Berger. And we did talk about her quickly before we started recording tonight. And I just think that there are so few ladies that, you know, people think of when they think of comic books and great comic book writers and artists and editors, even in 2019, you know, people that have been, you know, reading and stuff for a long time, like, you know, our age or older, you know, you always gravitate towards the Kirbys and this, you know, all those people. That, and that's great, and they're legends, and they should be. But, you know, people like Karen Berger and Jeanette Kahn, those people really need to be lifted up, because they, you know, Karen Berger, to me, when you read everything that's been written about her and all these professionals, what they have to say about her, she was really the heart and soul of Vertigo. You know, that machine really did what it did because of her.
I agree.
You know, so kudos to her, man.
Yeah, yeah. So also a great thank you, like you say, Billy, to Karen Berger for what she brought us and who she found to do the job, and her eye for talent and her eye for good stories and her skill at bringing it all together. So yeah, Vertigo, we'll remember you fondly. Man, there's so many great series there. Billy, just think about it. Okay, Swamp Thing and Sandman notwithstanding, you know, Hellblazer, they started before the Vertigo line was officially, you know, minted. But, you know, if you just rattle off The Invisibles, you know, Fables, Why the Last
Sandman.
Man, of course, Sandman and Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And Preacher, oh, man, 100 Bullets. I can't even begin to you know, express my love for, you know, all those comics. So, yeah, great, great imprint, and probably one of the best of all time that we will remember fondly for many, many years to come. So rest in peace, Vertigo. Just a quick aside here, listeners. While I was editing this episode, I had to insert this short but hopefully sweet farewell to another great and important part of my youth, which has since gone the way of the dodo, and that is, of course, Mad Magazine. When Billy and I first recorded this episode, we were upset about Vertigo's cancellation, and we mentioned that on this week's show, but I've since come to, you know, the sad realization that, of course, Mad Magazine is also now being cancelled. So I just wanted to put in this quick aside mentioning what Mad meant to me as a kid, as someone who's interested in art, and as someone whose father, in fact, started out doing a bit of commercial art. So, yeah, it was probably my dad who got me into Mad Magazine way back when, introduced me to all the artists, Mort Drucker, Jack Davis, Dick DeBartolo, Angelo Torres, Dave Berg, and of course Don Martin, one of my dad's absolute favorites, Duck Edwin, who became one of my favorites. But, yeah, the demise of Mad Magazine hopefully will ring in the ears of DCXX for a long time, because damn them. Damn them for canceling it. I understand why, though. We're living in a corporate world. Everything's profit-driven, so, of course, Mad Magazine wasn't making them any money. But I'm still feeling very disheartened that not more people were buying the magazine and in fact, supporting satire and comedy and cartooning of the highest caliber. So we'll miss you, Mad Magazine, me especially. And come next episode, I'll get Billy to weigh in and deliver his thoughts about the fact that Mad Magazine will be no more, and that we will, in fact, be living in a madless world, which I shudder to contemplate. So, yeah, that's it for our brief insert here about Mad Magazine. Let me know, listeners, what you think about this sad state of affairs. But for now, let's go back to our episode. All right, Billy, so we're heading into the final stretch. Our next segment will be our Allies of Agamotto. And then after that, we'll say our goodbyes. But don't go away yet, listeners. We've got another promo just on the horizon for you.
In 2014, two comic fans joined forces to do a Doom Patrol podcast. As there was no Doom Patrol comic series at the time, they called it Waiting for Doom.
That was us, me, Mike, and him, Paul.
In 2016, DC Comics became fearful of the power of Waiting for Doom and sought to appease us by bringing the comic back.
That's not exactly how it went.
In 2018, terrified of the sheer horde organizing power of Waiting for Doom, DC Universe announced a Doom Patrol TV show.
I think they were planning that without us.
In 2019, they again brought back the Doom Patrol comic, hoping we would not smite them.
This makes no sense.
In 2020, 2021, they realized we were the most unstoppable force in existence and released the Doom Patrol movie.
This is pure fantasy now.
In 2022, a terrified Motion Picture Academy awarded the Doom Patrol movie every single Oscar, including Best Documentary and Foreign Language Film.
That's enough, Paul. Look, we just love the Doom Patrol and have fun talking about them. You can find us on all podcast places and now Spotify.
And check out our website, waitingfordoom.com, or we will wipe you out, all of you.
And now we get to our Allies of Agamotto segment, where we thank the people who have been interacting with us, sending us messages, and supporting the show. First, I'd like to give a shout out to two of my Twitter buddies. They've been interacting a lot with Billy and myself, and also with Grant, our co-founder. And I'll start with the first one. It's a man by the name of Mr. William U. Potter. He's been listening to Into the Weird. He's been giving us lots of great advice. And I'm not sure about this because I couldn't find the exact tweet, but I'm pretty sure he is the follower who asked us whether we'd be covering the Defenders down the line. Now, that is the Defender series from the early Marvel Bronze Age, featuring Doctor Strange, Submariner, Silver Surfer, and the Hulk, and eventually also featured characters like the Valkyrie and Nighthawk and the Gargoyle and so forth. So, William, yes, we have decided that we are indeed going to be covering the Defenders soon. We'll leave that probably till after we're done with a bit more of Doctor Strange, but that's definitely one of my favorite series of all time. In fact, my favorite team comic of all time, and it's something that we've allowed Titan Up the Defense to cover. Not allowed. That's the wrong word. That sounds so uppity. What I mean to say is it's something that they do so well that we've deferred to them in the past. But, you know, we're willing to give our own spin on the Defenders as well. We might not be covering it issue by issue. We might do story arcs. And so thanks for that suggestion, William. I advise all of you listeners to follow William on Twitter. He's a very erudite man. I'm looking at his Twitter right now. And what it's the description is: a short, stunning Mexican girl, originally from Rome. He loves fishing, chemistry. Some say he tells a few white lies, but they've all gone to prison now. And he hails from Canterbury. So thanks for following us, William, and thanks for all the comments and feedback that you've given us in the past. The second Twitter follower that I want you all to take note of is a man steeped in werewolf lore, and this is Dr. Wolfman. Oh, and before I forget, you can follow Mr. William U. Potter at WH Potter. But Dr. Wolfman, I'm looking at his Twitter profile here. It says that he is the leading expert in lycanthropology, the world's leading expert, in fact. And he's a werewolf, of course. And I've been enjoying interacting with him. His knowledge of old movies and werewolf comics and horror is almost incomparable. So follow him, interact with Dr. Wolfman. He's a great source of fun and horror and weirdness. So thanks for interacting with us on the Twitters, Dr. Wolfman and Mr. Potter. We really enjoy that. Billy and I, we appreciate that a lot. And then we get to some more direct feedback we've received in the form of messages. The first one is from Mr. EC Portuguese. He contacted us through the sinkintotheweird.com website, and he said, "Great stories in those vampire tales, guys. I dig your podcast and all the material you cover. Thanks again, gents." And thank you, Mr. Portuguese, for your great feedback. In fact, it could be a woman. It could be a lady. But I don't know. I'm sorry about that if I'm wrong. If it is a lady, I apologize. But, you know, I'm assuming you're a man. Weird. All right. And then secondly, I want to give thanks to an email that we have recently received. And this is a very well-written and nice piece from a Mr. Ed Gosney. And Ed says, "Hi guys, I just started listening to your podcast, and since I consider myself a student of comic book history, Into the Weird is now part of my curriculum. I've collected comics off and on since the 70s, and I've been publishing a weekly blog, which is at edgosney.com, for nearly 4 years now. Over the last year, I've decided that I want to learn as much as I can about the creators and companies not only of today, but going back to the Golden Age. Therefore, I've been reading books about comics, Alter Ego Magazine, Back Issue Magazine, and so forth. Podcasts are a newer addition to my coursework, and Into the Weird is an important addition to my continuing education. Thanks so much for what you do. And that is Mr. Ed Gosney, ladies and gentlemen. A very nicely written email. Thank you, Ed, for your feedback. We appreciate it. And then I want to give a shout out to the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, run by Sean and Greg. Now, I've recently been a guest on their Squadron Supreme cast, where they're covering the 1980s 12-issue miniseries by Mark Gruenwalt, from writer Mark Gruenwalt, chronicling the Squadron Supreme, one of my favorites miniseries of all time. So give that a listen if you want to do that. That can be found at Secret Wars and Beyond podcast on all the podcasters, the podcatchers that you have at your disposal. Ugh, slurring my words here. So thank you, Sean and Greg, for that. And then, listeners, we've got some iTunes feedback. For those new to the show, I will again reiterate that when we get a 5-star review on iTunes, Billy Grant and I ascribe a superhero alter ego to the person leaving the 5-star review. Now, this can also be a 4-star review, but so far we've gotten lots of 5-star reviews and I'm working my way through them. And this review comes from someone known only as Audio Consumer. So I don't know if you're a man or a woman. I'm going to assume you're an it. No offense, Audio Consumer. And this review was posted earlier this year. Audio Consumer said in it, "I'm a big fan of the series. I love the focus on 70s Marvel weirdness. I could listen to 100 of these. My only complaint is the infrequency of episode releases. I'd like more. But listen to everything you can. It's great stuff." So he gave us a 5-star review. And thank you, Audio Consumer. We are working on that. We're trying to be more consistent. So far, I think we've almost succeeded, but we've still got a ways to go. And because you gave us a 5-star review, you are eligible to receive your very own Bronze Age alter ego from yours truly. I hope you like it, Audio Consumer. I didn't have much to go by other than your name, Audio Consumer. So I've based my Bronze Age moniker that I've created on that. So here we go, and I hope you like it. To understand the origins of the being once known as Audio Lad, Audio Lass, Kid Audio, Soundwave, Bandwidth, and Kid Crescendo, the discerning comic book scholar would have to look back, way back to the late Silver Age of comics, where a young artist by the name of Cave Dockrum was feverishly designing characters that he hoped would be featured in his favorite title, The Legion of Hyperheroes, from publisher CD Comics. Everything was sunshine and daisies one fine afternoon when young Cave put pencil and pen to paper as he meticulously sketched and inked a new character heroic in stature. Unsure of the character's name or gender at the time, Dave was, however, intent upon investing said character with sound-based powers. Sadly, the character was left insubstantial, half-formed, and incomplete as Dave's creative process slowed that day, leading him to relegate the half-finished sketch to the bottom of a stack of doodles filled with unfinished character design. Fast forward a few years later to 1972. David has finally realized his dream and has become a penciler for CD Comics. He scored a gig as regular artist on his favorite title, Hyperboy and the Legion of Hyperheroes, reinvigorating the comic and unleashing his fecund imagination. Everything is sunshine and daisies once again as Cave frolics in the perfect utopia of the Legion's 30th century adventures. His characters, untainted by the darkness that has by now overtaken the early Bronze Age of comics. Skip to 1974, and Cave is involved in an ugly dispute with CD Comics involving their refusal to return some of his original art. He leaves the company, taking with him some characters that he intended to introduce in the Legion universe, most notably characters called Tempesta and the Dusk Slitherer, and the as-yet-unnamed Sonic-powered hero or heroine he had created those many years ago in a more idyllic time. Jumping ship to rival comic publisher Marvelite Comics, Cave was helmed as the artist on their flagging title, The Z-Men, and tasked with bringing the comic back to prominence. He introduced a slew of new characters, with Tempesta and Dusk Slitherer at the forefront, joining the Z-Men along with the sound-powered character who had since been given a name by writer Wen Lin, who had dubbed the sound-powered character Cacophony. And this, dear listeners, is when the proverbial weird shit hit the fan. A burst of gamma rays from a far-off pulsar knocked over Cave's inks one day while he was finalizing the look of Cacophony, spilling supercharged liquid all over his immaculate illustration. Somehow, this cosmically induced chemical accident resulted in an inconceivable act of genesis, bringing life to that which had heretofore only been a two-dimensional figure on a piece of paper. And so, Cacophony was born, and as newly created creatures are fated to do, for reference I refer you, dear listeners, to Lucifer, Adam and Eve, the Frankenstein monster, and Rotwang's robot Maria from Fritz Lang's Metropolis, Cacophony rebelled against his or her existence, yearning for the lost utopia of the Legion of Hyperheroes and rejecting the dark Bronze Age of the Marvelite universe, now filled with monsters and vampires of all kinds. Using inborn sonic powers that increased the ambient noise in the surrounding environment a thousandfold, Cacophony devastated the Marvelite offices and left, leaving his or her creator a shivering wreck of a man. Seeking to make a living as a superhero, Cacophony soon learned that the ability to increase sound made one more a villain than a hero in the eyes and ears of the populace. This, coupled with the fact that he or she had inherited some Bronze Age darkness in the form of a vampiric sound-consuming need to fuel the cacophonous power he/she possessed, made the transition from hero to villain that much easier. Going up against such heroes as Scaredevil, who had also leaped off the page in the Marvelite offices as a result of the cosmic-charged ink, Cacophony has since undergone yet another name change. Though the papers and news sites have given her or him many nom de plumes, such as the Sonic Scamp, the Countess of Loudness, the Audible Atrocity, he or she has nevertheless settled on a final moniker, one that brought a smile to the faces of many villains and a frown to that of creator Cave Dockrum. With that, listeners, I introduce you to audio consumer, now universally known as the Decibel Demon. And that, audio consumer, is your Bronze Age Marvel moniker, or should I say Marvelite moniker. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. Let me know if you didn't, and I might be tempted to come up with an alternate identity for you. Or I might not, who knows? Time constraints being what they are. All right, listeners, that's it for our Allies of Agamotto segment. And right now, Billy and I will head on into our farewells. So don't go away yet. We'll be back with some contact info for you. right, listeners, so that's it for another episode of Into the Weird. Before we leave you, we'd like to provide you with some contact details. You can reach me, of course, on Twitter at darklongbox or at intoweird, which is the two Twitter handles we use to discuss all the stuff that Into the Weird leads us into, right, Billy? Horror, Hammer movies, Marvel Bronze Age, just anything in general, anything cool, anything weird, anything offbeat. And then, of course, you can also check out our blog at sinkintotheweird.com. And please, if you want to leave any feedback regarding this episode or previous issues, you can do so by sending us a mail or a voice file, which is something we covet, to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. Yes, please send us some feedback. We'd love to read the feedback on the show or even play any voice messages or voice files. I feel like I'm starting to beg, Billy, begging for voice messages. I did that during the last episode too, but come on, I really want to play one. I might even get my wife Erin to send one fake voice message just to fill that need. So Billy, what about you? Where can they reach you on the web?
For sure, very active on Twitter. So that's the place you can find me pretty much on a daily basis from sunup to sundown. It's at @BillyD_Licious. And then also magazinesandmonsters.com, my blog, and Facebook page by the same name, Magazines and Monsters.
Excellent, Billy. So listeners, we'll leave you with this message of weirdness, which is weird is cool. Stay weird. Don't change. Read some Bronze Age, bask in the strangeness and the weirdness and the just plain craziness of good old-fashioned comics. The way comics are meant to be done. Right, Billy?
Absolutely weird.
Weird is best. So with that, we'll leave you, listeners. Have a wonderful week. And until we meet again, this is Herman and Billy signing off for Into the Weird. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Clea, you got me on my knees, Clea, I'm begging, darling, please, Clea, darling, won't you ease my weary mind? I try to give you consolation when Dormammu let you down. Like a fool, I fell in love with you, turned my whole world upside down. Clea, you got me on my knees, Clea, I'm begging the Vishanti, please, Clea, darling, won't you ease my weary mind?